questions from U.S. Immigration. They processed me without delay, I retrieved my luggage, and stepped out into the pouring rain. I was home, but I found less comfort in it than I had anticipated. I'd been away so long, it was a country I barely knew. 18 hours had passed since I had left the Bradleys at the Plaza Athénée. Once I realized my cover had been blown, I knew what I had to do. The training was unambiguous. Run, take shelter wherever you can, try to regroup, and then write your will. Maybe not the last part, but that was the tone in which a blown cover was always discussed. I figured America was my best chance. Not only would it be harder for an enemy to find me among millions of my own, but I knew if I was ever going to be safe, I had to erase the fingerprints I had left behind, making it impossible for others to follow the path Ben and Marcy had pioneered. I had covered the distance between the Plaza Athénée and my apartment in 6 minutes, and as soon as I walked in, I started to call the airlines. By luck, there was one seat left in first class on the earliest flight out. It is strange how the unconscious mind works, though. In the ensuing chaos of grabbing clothes, settling bills, and packing my bags, the two letters from Bill and Grace Murdoch's lawyer suddenly floated into my thoughts for no apparent reason. I rummaged through a file of old correspondence, threw them into my carry-on, and turned to the only issue which remained: the contents of the safe. It was impossible to take the 3 handguns, $100,000 in different currencies, and 8 passports with me, not even in my checked luggage. If the metal detectors or X-rays picked it up, even as an alleged diplomat, I would come under intense scrutiny. Once they discovered it was a fake book, as they surely would, I would have weeks of explaining to do. First about my real identity, and then about the other items. All guns, false passports, and contact books were supposed to have been surrendered when I left the division. Instead, I slid open a seam of my mattress, removed some of the filling, and taped the tools of my trade inside. Once I was in America, I would call Francois, the sniveling concierge, and have him arrange for a moving company to transport all my furniture back home. With everything secure, I glued the seam closed, refitted the mattress cover, and called a cab to take me to Charles de Gaulle. 10 hours later, I was standing in the rain at Kennedy, telling another cab to head for Midtown. On the way, I called the Four Seasons, one of those hotels where sheer size guarantees anonymity, and booked a room. After 3 days of traipsing between realtors, I rented a small loft in NoHo. It wasn't much, but it caught the morning light, and on my first day living there, I found the letters from the lawyer and called to make an appointment. We sat in his expansive office in the late afternoon, looking all the way up Central Park, and what he had described as a small matter concerning Bill's estate managed to change my life forever. For several days afterwards, I walked the city late into the night, turning the matter over and over in my head, trying, as a psychologist would say, to internalize it. I let my feet carry me wherever they chose, passing crowded bars and restaurants, skirting the long lines outside the hippest clubs and latest movies. Finally, footsore and painfully aware of how little experience I had of what people call a normal life, I began to accept what the lawyer had told me. Only then did I turn to the problem of fingerprints. My first call was to an FBI supervisor, the woman to whom I had handed over the division's European files when the agency was closed down. She contacted one of her deputy directors, whispered that I had once been the writer of The Blue, and I sat down with him a day later in a shabby conference room in a bland downtown tower. After I had asked to speak to him alone and his 2 aides had closed the door behind them, I explained that Scott Murdoch's social security number had been eliminated and the danger that presented to me. It took him a moment to master his incredulity, but once he had finished cursing whoever was responsible, he made a phone call and set about having the number restored. "I'll flag it. I'll make sure if anybody ever inquires about the number, you'll be warned," he said. "What else?" "Someone to go in and alter computer databases. There's a lot of information about me, or the aliases I've used, which has to be lost." "Government or private computers?" he asked. "Both," I said. "Everything from the records of an alumni association at a school called Caulfield Academy through to scores of announcements in the Federal Register." No hope, the deputy director said. Databases are stripper rules. The Supreme Court says we can look, but we can't touch. It'd be illegal for me even to point you towards somebody who could help. I pressured him, telling him about the years I'd served my country, explaining why I needed him to break the rules. He nodded thoughtfully, and something seemed to tip him over the edge, and he started ranting. Break the rules? You're asking me to get involved in computer hacking. Any idea how much that cost the community? This isn't geeks. That was years ago. Cyberspace is Ram Raiders now. Smash into a site, ignore the damage, steal anything of value. I was stunned. I didn't care about the Supreme Court or modern developments in cybercrime. I just wanted to clean up my past. I figured I must have touched a nerve, but that wasn't going to help me get to safety. He was on a roll, though, and he wasn't stopping. There's a level even higher than the Rammers, he continued. Call them cat burglars. They get in, copy everything, and nobody knows they've been there. They are the brilliant ones. Had one guy stole 15 million mortgage files. 15 million! Each one included someone's credit card details, social security number, bank account, home address. Know what he was going to do with them? Identity theft? I said. No idea why we were still talking about this. Of course, but he wasn't going to use it himself. Oh, no, that was too much like hard work. He was going to sell him to the Russian mafia. A buck each for the first million, he told us, just to get him in. Then he was going to ride the up elevator until he got 10 bucks a file. Figured he'd make 100 million for sitting in front of a screen. You know how much the average bank robber gets? He asked, leaning over the table. 9,000 bucks and maybe a bullet. Who do you think found the right business plan? I shrugged. I really didn't care. The guy is 23, probably the best in the world. How long did he go down for? I asked, trying to show some interest. Not decided. Maybe zip. Depends if he keeps cooperating and helps nail the samurai crackers that are doing equally bad stuff. Battle Boy was his online handle, so that's what we call him. Battle Boy? I said, not certain I'd heard right. Yeah, with an I. Hispanic fucker. Grew up in Miami, but lives nearby now, just off Canal Street above Walgreens. He looked at me and our eyes met. The scales fell away, and I realized why he had been telling the story. Anyway, enough about my problems. I have to stop before I say something illegal, he said. Anything else I can do? Nothing. You've done more than enough. Thank you, I said warmly. He got up and started to lead the way out. Pausing at the door, he turned to face me. I'm glad I could help with the Social Security problem. I know your reputation. A lot of us do. And it's been an honor, a real honor, to meet the Rider of the Blue. He said it with such admiration, his handshake strong enough to turn coal to diamonds, it took me aback. He and his aides watched in silence, with respect, I suppose you could call it, as I walked towards the elevator. Flattered as I was, I couldn't help thinking of how a man gets burnt out long before his reputation. Once outside, I got a cab and rode across town, looking out at the passing faces. With the shadows lengthening into night, I once again had a strange feeling of detachment, of being a stranger in my own land. I knew if a person kept traveling down that road, they ended up dying to the world. You see them sitting on park benches, in reading rooms at public libraries, alone at railroad stations. Some future, I thought. But there was nothing I could do. The caravan rolls on, the dogs keep barking, and it was imperative that I buried my past. The cab stopped in front of Walgreens. I walked the length of the building and found a doorway tucked into the wall. There was only one intercom, and the few words next to it were in Japanese. Great. Wondering if somehow I had misunderstood the FBI guy, I pressed it anyway. Chapter 13. A man's gruff voice answered in English. I told him a mutual friend who worked on the 23rd floor of a nearby building had suggested I call around. He buzzed me in and I climbed a flight of stairs, noting that someone had worked hard to conceal 4 closed-circuit cameras monitoring the stairway. Worried about the Russian mafia, I guessed. I turned into a corridor, and it was only after my eyes had adjusted to the gloom that I saw him. Battle Boy was standing straight ahead, just inside the type of steel door which would have made a crack house proud. The most surprising thing about him wasn't his size, though he weighed in at around 400 pounds. The shocking thing was that he was dressed like a medieval Japanese daimyo. A samurai cracker of the First Order, I realized. He was wearing a shockingly expensive silk kimono and traditional Japanese white socks notched for the big toe. His black hair oiled and swept back tight into a top knot. If anybody ever needs a Hispanic sumo wrestler, I know just the guy. He bowed slightly, the minimum of good manners. I guessed he didn't like our friend from the 23rd floor very much, and stood aside to let me enter. Admittedly, his feudal lands only extended to four rooms on a side street, but beautiful tatami mats covered the floors, shoji screens separated the spaces, and on one wall was an antique painted screen of Mount Fuji, which I bet would have cost at least 20,000 of his most expensive files. Once across the threshold, I only just avoided a social disaster. At the last moment, I realized I was supposed to swap my shoes for a pair of guest sandals. While I undid my barbarian boots, I asked what I should call him. He looked blank.
What do you mean? They didn't tell you?
Well, yeah, they told me, I replied. It just doesn't seem right calling somebody Battle Boy to their face. He shrugged.
Doesn't worry me, dickhead, he said,
and led the way to a pair of cushions on the floor. The deputy director says you're cooperating with him, I said, as if I were there with the man's complete authority. He looked at me with disgust, but didn't deny it.
What do you want?
As we sat cross-legged, I explained about deleting every reference to Scott Murdoch from the databases held by the alumni associations of my former schools. I figured that was as good a place as any to start. He asked who Murdoch was, and I told him I didn't know. It's been decided to Deep Six is past. That's all we've got to worry about. He asked for Murdoch's date of birth, details of the alumni associations, and a host of other questions to make sure that he got the right person. After I answered, he adjusted his kimono and said we'd start in a few minutes.
Johnny,
he said casually, but I got the subtext. I was supposed to look blank and feel inferior, but honestly, I wasn't in the mood. I reached in a memory to a summer long ago. I was on a blood-soaked beach, surrounded by a rash of beheadings and scores of samurai committing ritual suicide. In other words, I had spent my vacation reading Shogun. Out of all those epic pages, I remembered a few key phrases. Cha was tea.
Hi, domo,
I said, hoping my memory hadn't failed me and I was saying yes, thank you, and not go fuck yourself. I must have got it right.
You speak Japanese?
He said, with a mixture of astonishment and respect. Oh, just a little, I said modestly. He clapped his hands and one of the screens slid open. A slim Hispanic chick dressed in a red silk kimono entered and bowed, prompting in me a question which has occupied the minds of great philosophers since time immemorial. How come unattractive guys nearly always get the hot women? She was a couple of years younger than him, with large eyes and a sensuous mouth. On closer inspection, it was clear she had freely adapted the traditional kimono. It was much tighter across her hips and boobs than you would ever see in Tokyo. To facilitate movement, she had slashed it at the back from the hem up to her thigh, and as she moved across the room, it was obvious from the way the silk rippled and clung to her, she didn't have to worry about panty lines and bra straps. She wasn't wearing either. The overall effect was both alluring and crazy.
Tea?
She asked. I nodded, and Battle Boy turned to me.
This is Rachel's son.
She glanced my way and gave the thinnest of smiles.
Battle Boy? Rachel's son? Old Japan above Walgreens?
No matter what the FBI said about his abilities, I didn't hold out much hope. It looked to me like I was dealing with a pair of care in the community cases. 3 hours later, I was forced to revise my opinion drastically. Not only had Lorenzo, at least that's what Rachel had called him once, deleted all references to me from the Alumni Association records. He said he could do the same to the far more complex files held by Caulfield Academy and Harvard themselves. "You can get rid of an entire academic and attendance record?" I asked. "Make it look like Scott Murdoch never even went to Caulfield or Harvard?"
"Why not?" he laughed. "There are so many people on the fucking planet now. That's all we are. Lines of code on a hard drive. Take the lines away and we don't exist. Add to it and we're really somebody. Want a full professorship? Tell me the faculty. Need 100 million large? Wait while I manipulate some binary code. By the way, you can call me God if you like."
"Thanks, but I've kind of come to like Battle Boy," I smiled. Late that night, I watched as he consigned the last of Dr. Murdoch's academic achievements to the electronic void.
"It's a shame. All that study and now it's gone," he said.
There was little I could say, too awash with memories, especially of Bill. He'd driven up in his old Ferrari to Boston, the only person who had come to see me graduate. Once Lorenzo was satisfied that he hadn't left behind any sign that he had accessed the data, I told him about the next item on my list. The information that had to be excised from government computers and job announcements.
"How many entries?" he asked.
"A couple of hundred, probably more." From the look on his face, you would think I had invited him to commit seppuku.
"Let me guess. This is urgent, eh?"
But he didn't wait for a reply. He knew the answer.
"You got copies of these announcements, or do we have to dig them out ourselves?"
I hesitated. Ben Bradley and his wife had all the information, but they were the last people I wanted to ask. "I'd have to think about that," I replied.
"If we've got to start from scratch, it could take months. Let me know what you decide," he said,
and started closing down his racks of hard drives. As he walked me to the door, he'd become relaxed enough for a little small talk.
"I've been studying Japanese for 3 years. Bitch of a language, huh? Where'd you learn it?"
"Shogun," I said simply, and after he had overcome his shock, I have to say he took it with enormous good grace. The mountain of flesh shook as he laughed at his gullibility, and with his eyes dancing and that great generosity of spirit, I glimpsed what Rachel must have first seen in him.
"Shit," he said, wiping the tears from his eyes. "And I've spent the last 6 hours feeling inadequate, just like being in high school again."
As I put my boots back on, emboldened by our laughter, he asked,
"What exactly do you do at the FBI?
"I don't. It's complicated. I suppose you could say I used to be a fellow traveler with them, that's all."
"Are you Scott Murdoch?"
I laughed again. "You think if I had those qualifications, I'd be sitting on my ass talking to you?" I hit just the right tone of bitterness and humor. I'm a hell of a good liar when I need to be.
"Whoever you are, you must be tight with the 23rd floor."
"Not really. Why?"
"I was hoping you could put a word in with the deputy director, ask him to go easy on the charges."
"My understanding is, if you keep cooperating, there may not be any charges."
"Sure," he laughed bitterly. "That's why they've set up a special division for cybercrime. It's their brave new world. I figure they'll bleed me for everything I've got, then double-cross me. You know, just to make an example."
I shook my head, telling him he was paranoid. They didn't operate like that. But of course, he was right. Some months later, they hit him with every charge they could find, then offered him a plea deal that was no deal at all. In the end, unable to afford any more lawyers, he had even sold his treasured Mount Fuji screen, he was forced to sign it. 15 years in Leavenworth was what he got. And he would have languished there, virtually forgotten, except that, in a frightening avalanche of developments, the search for the Saracen hit a desperate pass. Chapter 14. The Saracen arrived at the Syrian border just before lunchtime. Getting off the bus from Beirut with a leather medical bag in one hand, a nondescript suitcase in the other, and a remarkable plan in mind. It was 5 years since he had graduated, with honors, as a doctor, and those were the missing years, the hungry years. It took me a long time to piece together his movements during that period, but one thing was beyond doubt. By the time he fronted the Syrian immigration officer, he had solved the riddle, which had occupied all his waking moments. He knew how to attack America. As a doctor who claimed to be on his way to work in the sprawling refugee camps, he had his Lebanese passport stamped without any difficulty. Skirting the taxi drivers and assorted hustlers, he turned left in the trash-strewn parking lot and found a public bus that would take him into Damascus. At the city's main bus depot, he checked his two bags at the stored luggage counter, exited a side entrance, and started to walk. He was determined to leave as little evidence as possible of his movements, and for that reason, he wouldn't even take a cab. For over an hour, he made his way down dusty roads and through increasingly grim neighborhoods. Damascus is home to almost 2 million people, 500,000 of whom are impoverished Palestinian refugees. At last, at the intersection of two freeways, he found what he was looking for. Beneath the elevated roads was a no-man's land, a petrified forest of concrete pylons blackened by diesel fumes. The area was decorated by colored lights, limp flags, and quotes from the Quran, which attested to the proprietor's love of honesty. They were used car lots. Here, at the bottom of the automotive food chain, the Saracen chose an ancient Nissan Sunny. While the salesman praised the skill of a man who could see past the rust and find the diamond on the lot, the Saracen paid in cash. He added an extra 5 Syrian pounds in order to dispense with the transfer papers and headed off into the dusk. The car burnt more oil than gas, but the Saracen didn't care. Transport was only the vehicle's secondary purpose. The primary one was accommodation. He knew that even in cheap hotels, people remembered too much, and he spent 3 hours driving the city before he found a secluded area at the back of a supermarket parking lot and took up residence. Over the weeks that followed, he assembled the material he needed for the task ahead and let his personal hygiene go to hell. He started wearing clothes that were increasingly grimy, and while this might have offended his own standards, he had little choice. His plan depended on him being a perfect version of a homeless man. Finally, after one long surveillance trip to the battlefield, he was ready. On the outskirts of Damascus, a 4-story glass and concrete building stood almost alone. The sign out front said, "The Syrian Institute for Advanced Medicine," but its exact purpose was unclear. Nobody could remember the last time the country's leaders sought medical treatment anywhere except in the private clinics of London or Paris. Because Western intelligence was worried that the building was being used for nuclear or biological research, one of 8 U.S. satellites which patrolled the Middle East kept the institute under constant surveillance. It photographed faces through windows, recorded all deliveries, and monitored the chemical signature of emissions, but unfortunately, didn't take any photos of the immediate surroundings. As a result, there have never been any images of the homeless man who, according to a later report by the Syrian secret police, arrived in bits and pieces. Early one Friday evening, a security guard, passing through a garden at the end of the building, saw that an old tarp had been strung between two palms, colonizing under its shade a standpipe used to water the plants. A few days later, a tiny cooking ring, a salvaged gas bottle, and a battered cool box also took up residence. But still, the scores of people who walked by on their way from the parking lot to the front of the institute hadn't actually seen the homesteader. Not even after a well-worn copy of the Quran in an antique binding and 2 threadbare blankets appeared. By then, it was too late to do anything about it. Ramadan, the 9th month in the Islamic calendar and by far its most sacred, had started. The holy book on the blanket acted as a mute reminder to everyone that beggars, travelers, and the poor have to be provided for under Islam. What true believer would have a homeless man removed during Ramadan? It was only then, protected by his religion, that the Saracen appeared, abandoning the Nissan in the supermarket parking lot, emerging on foot out of the dry scrub, settling in under the tarp as if he already belonged, which I'm sure was his plan. Bearded and ragged, wearing the anonymous long tunic and headdress of the countless thousands of Palestinian refugees, He cracked open the standpipe for some drinking water and started reading the Quran. At the ordained times, he filled his saucepan, performed the washing that precedes the 5 daily prayers, and pointed his mat at what was either Mecca or the security guard's toilet, depending, I suppose, on your view of the world. Nobody complained about his presence, and he was over the first hurdle. The next morning, he started work, washing the windows of parked cars, sweeping up trash, and generally acting as guardian of Al-Aba parking lot number 3. Like most refugees, he never asked for money, but he did place a saucer on the walkway, just in case someone felt a sudden urge to fulfill their charitable obligations. By any measure, it was brilliant. Several weeks later, after the mutilated body of one of the Institute's most senior officers was found, the police and Syrian spooks flooded the surrounding buildings, finally targeting the homeless man and trying to build a photo fit. Everybody they spoke to was in agreement. 5'11", say about 180, heavily bearded, and then, well, pretty much nothing. In the secret world, a disguise and life story that have been invented to hide someone's real identity is called a legend. The ragged guardian of Al-Aba parking lot number 3, a Saudi Arabian, a graduate in medicine from Beirut University, a hero of the Afghan War, had created a legend as a Palestinian refugee so effective it had rendered him virtually invisible. For a professional to have done it would have been a great achievement. For an amateur without resources or training, it was remarkable. A week after his arrival, the Saracen established the habit during the hottest part of the day of crouching with his Quran in a grove of palms near the building's front door, taking advantage of a cool breeze from a faulty air conditioning conduit. While people smiled at his ingenuity, the truth was he didn't give a damn about the heat. He had lived in the outer ring of hell during blazing summers in Afghanistan, so fall in Damascus didn't worry him. No, the area under the conduit allowed him to see, through a plate glass wall, the exact security procedures which applied to everyone entering the building. Once he was convinced he understood them, he set about weighing, both figuratively and literally, the people who worked at the place. The deputy director of the Institute was always among the last to leave. In his 50s, his name was Bashar Tlas, a relative of one of Syria's ruling elite, a former prominent member of the country's secret police, and, I'm sorry to say, an unmitigated piece of scum. But neither his high position, his qualifications as a chemical engineer, nor his love of the slow garrote during his career with the secret police had any bearing on why he was chosen. It would have been a great surprise to everybody, class included, that the reason he was killed was because he weighed 180 pounds. Or, at least as near as the doctor, sitting among the palm trees, could tell. Having identified his target, all the Saracen had to do now was wait. Throughout the Muslim world, Ramadan's 30 days of fasting, prayer, and sexual abstinence end with an explosion of feasting, gifts, and hospitality called Eid al-Fitr. The evening before the festival of Eid, almost everyone leaves work early to get ready for the ritual of dawn prayer, followed by a day of huge banquets. Damascus was no different, and by 4 p.m., banks and offices were locked, shops were closed, and the roads increasingly deserted. Klass walked out the front door of the Institute and heard the security guards at their console behind him activate the electronic locks. It meant the building was completely empty, and he knew, as did everyone else, that as soon as he was out of sight, the guards would arm the rest of the system and quietly head home to make their own preparations for the festivities. Years ago, the director had tried to get the guards to work over-eyed, but had run into so much opposition, including from the employees' mosques, that everybody had immediately reverted to the prior practice of contrived ignorance. And anyway, nobody knew better than Klass that the country was a police state. Who would be foolish enough to try to break into a government building? He got the answer to that question a few minutes later, as he walked down a path between the gardens, heading for his car. The few surrounding buildings and parking lots were deserted, so he was mildly alarmed when he turned a corner and, momentarily enclosed by hedges and palms, heard a rustle of movement behind him. He swung round, then almost smiled as he realized it was just the stupid Palestinian, The man who kept insisting on washing the windshield of his SUV, even though he had never dropped so much as a piastra into the tin saucer for his trouble. Now the beggar thought he had him cornered, bowing all the time as he came closer, holding out his saucer for money, murmuring the traditional greeting, Eid Mubarak. Tlas gave the greeting back, as tradition demanded, but that was all he was giving. He brushed the saucer aside and turned to continue down the path. The Saracen's arm exploded across the tiny distance between them, and in one blurred moment, it locked tight around Tlas's neck, startling and choking him in equal measure. The deputy director's first thought, born out of fury, was that there was no way he was letting him have any money. The refugee would have to kill him to get it. The second was how could a beggar, living on nothing more than garbage, be so fucking strong? Already Tlas was gasping for breath, and as he dredged up from memory the unarmed combat move to counteract a chokehold, desperately trying to implement it, he felt a searing pain rip into the base of his neck. Blinded by the swelling heat of it, he would have screamed if he could have found the air. He knew immediately it wasn't a knife. That would have slashed his throat and sent the warmth of his own blood streaming down his chest. The thought had barely formulated itself when a ball of fire burst into the muscle of his neck and started bullying into his bloodstream. The pain staggered him, but he knew now what it was. A syringe, with the plunger being driven down hard. Given the circumstances, it was an impressive piece of reasoning. Entirely accurate, too. Confused and terrified, Tlas knew he had to yell for help quickly, but whatever chemical was flooding his body suddenly meant the muscles of his mouth wouldn't say the words that were screaming in his head. The chemical flood hit his limbs. He realized with a wild rage that nothing could stop it now, and he saw his car keys fall from the jelly that used to be his hand. His attacker's fingers flashed out and caught them in midair, and it seemed to tell Tlas, more than any other thing, that he was in the hands of a master. Chapter 15. Tlas buckled at the knees. The Saracen caught him before he fell and half carried him towards his vehicle, a black American SUV, the same one whose windshield he had washed so many times. Halfway there, he stopped. He smacked Tlas hard across the face and saw the prisoner's eyes spark with pain and fury. During the planning, one of his major concerns had been that intravenous sedatives recovered from a body might contain a chemical marker that would allow them to be traced to a batch number. Such a number would lead to the regional hospital he had been working at in Lebanon, and it wouldn't take diligent investigators, a team from the Syrian secret police, for example, very long to start working through the list of employees and find that he was supposedly on vacation during the relevant period. There were, however, enough donkeys hauling carts in Beirut for the city to have developed a large and unregulated market in veterinary products. As a result, it was an ampule of an untraceable horse tranquilizer that was ripping through Tlas's body now, and the Saracen only hoped he had calculated the dose correctly. Enough to inhibit any muscle control, but not so much that it caused the victim to pass out. If Tlas's eyes glazed over, the man would be useless. Whatever else happened, the prisoner had to stay alert. Whack! The Saracen hit him across the face again for good measure, then resumed hauling him towards the SUV. Just as he had learned by observing Tlas while he washed the windshield, he used the button on the key to unlock the doors, opened the rear one, and bundled the prisoner inside. The interior of the vehicle was like a cave. All through the searingly hot countries that extend from the Mediterranean down past the Arabian Gulf, there is one unfailing way to work out who has wasta and who doesn't. The slang word for it is makfi, and it means tent, as in the coating you put on car windows to keep the sun out. Restricted by law to 15%, the more wasta you have, the more makfi you can get away with. Tlas had a great deal of wasta indeed, and the windows of his Cadillac were tinted to an intimidating 80%, making the cabin almost completely private, ideal for what was about to take place within. The Saracen swung in behind his prisoner, slammed the door, climbed into the driver's seat, put the key in the ignition, and turned the engine on. He wasn't going anywhere, but he needed the air conditioning blowing as cold as possible. He flicked the switch that operated the rear seats and watched the bench lie down until Klaas was flopping about on a flat platform like a tuna on the deck. Working to the choreography he had planned for weeks, he pulled rolls of thick electrical tape out of his pocket and scrambled onto the platform. Klaas watched in mute terror as the master grabbed his wrists, taping them to grab handles on the doors, spreading him out face up, just as Klaas had once done to a naked woman he had taken great pleasure in interrogating until she became too exhausted to scream and he had grown bored and garroted her. The master then taped Klaas's feet, thighs, and chest to the platform, making sure he couldn't move. What happened next, however, was the strangest thing of all. The master taped Klaas's forehead and chin tight to the headrest, holding his head as rigid as if it were in a workshop clamp. Klaas tried to speak, wanting to know what the hell he was doing. After all, it wasn't as if you could use your head to escape. But no words would come from his drooling mouth. With quiet satisfaction, the Saracen saw him trying to speak, watched his terrified eyes dart about. He knew for certain that he had got the dose of sedative right. Certain that Klaas, spread-eagled, was incapable of movement, the Saracen opened the rear door, checked the surrounding area was clear, slid out, and ran to his encampment. In one crashing move, he pulled the tarpaulin down from its anchors and piled his gas ring and other possessions onto it, leaving nothing behind to help the forensic analysts. He tied the tarp into a bundle, flung it over his shoulder, and picked up his old cool box, carefully packed by him earlier in the day, as if he were preparing for some bizarre picnic. The last thing that he had stowed in it was what had caused him the most anxiety, a large bag of ice. For weeks he had mulled over the problem of how to acquire it, but when the answer came it was disarmingly simple. He asked the friendliest of the security guards, the same one who had told him about the practice of the guards disappearing for Eid, to help him keep some drinks cool for his own simple celebration of the festival.
"Would it be possible to have some ice from the refrigerator in the staff kitchen?"
he had asked the guard, and the good Muslim had duly delivered it a few hours ago.
"Eid Mubarak,"
they had said to each other, as the Saracen stashed it in the cool box. On top of two small plastic containers, some food scraps, and several bottles of cordial, which were really just a blind. The real contents of the cool box, the rest of the specialist equipment he needed, were hidden in a concealed compartment at the bottom. With the cool box under his arm and the bundle on his back, he ran to the SUV. Klaas heard a rear door open, and his wild eyes swiveled to see the Palestinian load his possessions on board, swing himself in behind, and slam the door shut. Ominously, the master reached forward and hit a switch, operating the central locking system, sealing them inside. The Saracen reached down and emptied the deputy director's pockets, setting aside his cell phone, opening up his wallet, ignoring the money and credit cards, and finding exactly what he needed. Klaas's security keycard. Feeling more confident by the minute, he knelt down, carefully positioned himself close to Klaas's head, and took the lid off the cool box. He unloaded the food and released the catch that allowed him to remove the false bottom. From out of the hidden compartment, he took a heavy plastic pouch rolled and tied with a cord and laid it down beside him. Next, he began to fill the two plastic containers with ice. And there was something in the calm and orderly way he did all these things that Klaas recognized.
"The fucker's a doctor," he said in his head, it being the only place he could speak right then.
His eyes darted around frantically. The startling insight had made him more frightened than he would have ever thought possible. What sort of sick fuck, with all that study behind him, and a good career ahead as long as he kept his nose clean, would sweep up a parking lot, he wanted to know. Somebody with a plan was the answer he immediately gave himself. And, in his experience, men with plans were usually fanatics, not the sort of people you could reason with, even if you could get your muscles to say the words you so desperately needed to. The doctor took a pair of clear plastic gloves out of the secret compartment. They terrified Klaas in some even deeper place.
"What are they for?"
he tried to scream. As if in answer, the doctor spoke to him. In different circumstances, people had complimented him on his bedside manner.
"I'm going to take your eyes," he said.
Chapter 16.
"What did he say?"
Klaas screamed to himself. "What did the fucktard say about my eyes?" The Saracen watched as panic spiked in the two dark orbs. In truth, he had no interest in explaining to Klaas what he was doing, but he needed the rush of fear and adrenaline to dilate the pupils and engorge the organs with blood. The more blood in them, the longer the eyes would retain the appearance of life after they had been removed.
"I don't know you," the Saracen told him, "so it's nothing personal."
But of course, the Saracen did know him. He knew him in the way that he was always imagining the men who had led his father into a cell in Jeddah so many years ago.
"Nothing personal,"
Klaas yelled inside his head. He was right. The guy was a fanatic. That's what the fanatics always said. He tried to muster every hidden reserve, every ounce of energy, willing his muscles to act, trying to buck himself free. The Saracen watched a tiny ripple of movement shimmy down the man's body. It was sad, really. Klaas's eyes filled with tears, a fear, a frustration of hate. The Saracen reached down, picked up the plastic pouch, and untied the cord, allowing it to unroll. It was a surgical kit, and he was happy for Klaas to see it. Another spike of adrenaline and fear, he hoped. Out of one of the pockets, he drew an instrument, a 4-inch steel scalpel. Klaas stared at it.
A fucking scalpel?
He had to do something, anything. There was the spike, the Saracen noted with satisfaction.
"I think the right eye first,"
he said. By marshaling every sinew in his diminished body, Klaas managed to speak.
"No!"
he gasped in a strangled whisper. If the Saracen heard him, he made no sign.
"Removing the eyes is a relatively easy procedure,"
he said calmly, wrapping his fingers around the handle of the instrument. Klaas started climbing a black wall of terror and despair as he watched the scalpel slide towards what many people regard as the most vulnerable part of their body. The blade loomed huge in his right eye as the doctor's thumb and forefinger kept his eyelids apart. With one deft movement, the Saracen started cutting the lids away.
"Technically speaking, it's called an enucleation," he said helpfully.
Klaas thought he was going to vomit. He wanted to vomit anything that might stop the madman. Blood ran down, half obscuring the sight in his right eye. He could feel the lunatic's thumb working between the bridge of his nose and the side of the eyeball. The Saracen was pushing the eyeball aside, finding the orbital muscles that held it in its socket, slicing the sinew. Klaas was drowning under cresting waves of pain, but still he could see out of the eye that was being operated on. Ha! It wasn't going to work! The Saracen located the last anchor, the optic nerve, and the blood supply which coiled around it. Then he cut it. Half of Klaas's visible universe instantly disappeared, sucked into a black hole. The eyeball popped out. The Saracen had to work fast now, tying off the blood supply to the eyeball with a ligature, trying to keep as much fluid as possible trapped within it, plunging the ball into the ice to slow its deterioration. It was the same reason the air conditioning was blasting. He turned his attention to the left eye. As fast as he had been before, he worked at twice the speed now. Klaas lost the other half of the universe in a few seconds. The pain so intense he was barely conscious enough to realize that he was totally blind now. The Saracen opened the locks of the Cadillac, hit the parking lot running, and sprinted for the front doors of the Institute. In his hand, he carried Klaas's two eyes, firmly nestled in their separate containers of ice. But they were only the first part of the jigsaw. The next problem was the question of weight. Chapter 17. The encrypted key card which the Saracen had taken from Klaas's wallet did its job instantly, and the front doors of the Institute slid open. Although the security desk was unmanned and the building deserted, the metal detectors were still operating. He stepped through without any difficulty. Hours ago, he had taken off his watch and emptied his pockets. He strode 6 more paces and stopped. In front of him was a narrow corridor, the only way forward and blocked at the far end by an automatic steel door. Between him and that, the floor consisted of a long metal panel. Through the plate glass window, while supposedly enjoying the broken air conditioning conduit, he had unlocked one of the building's many security secrets. The floor was a hidden scale. Before stepping onto the metal, you had to swipe your encrypted card through another reader. A computer then married the name on the card to a database, which checked the weight of the individual. If it hadn't been for that precaution, the Saracen could have grabbed Klaas by the scruff of the neck and walked through behind him. But 2 men of 180 standing on the floor would have shut the building down. Still wearing the surgical gloves, the Saracen ran Klaas's card through the reader. He stepped onto the scale with no idea what tolerance for error the system operated on, half expecting shutters to fall from the ceiling, trapping him. Nothing happened. His guess that Klaas had been the same weight as him was right. Now for the last hurdle, a retina scanner. He put the ice containers on a ledge and took an eye in each hand, noting which was left and which was right. Holding a slippery ball in his thumb and forefinger, he jammed them hard against his own eyelids, deep into the bony socket. Unable to see, with only hope and prayer to sustain him, he turned to face the scanner in the wall. He knew his gloved hands were no problem. The system was designed to ignore plastic or wireframe glasses, contact lenses, makeup, and anything else. It was interested in only one thing: the blood vessels in the membrane at the back of the eye, each pattern unique among the 6 billion individuals on Earth, even those born as identical twins. The manufacturer claimed the technology could not be beaten, and while it was true that the retinas of dead people decayed very fast, the real question was whether eyes taken from a living person and fewer than 3 minutes old would have enough blood left in them to convince the software that this was Bashar Klaas standing in front of it. The Saracen had no way of knowing the answer, and probably nobody else did either. It wasn't as if someone had ever volunteered to find out. As a result of his observations, the Saracen knew that most people faced the scanner for about 2 seconds, so he forced himself to count to 3 and turned away. He dropped the eyes in the ice and turned towards the metal door at the far end. Again, he started counting. The longest he had seen anybody wait for it to open was to a count of 4. He reached a slow 6 and knew he would have to run. His abort strategy was to smash through the plate glass window on the assumption that the key card and doors would have been frozen by the system. Once outside, he would drive the SUV to an area near a garbage dump, which he had already reconnoitered, terminate Klaas, and walk 20 miles to the bus station. He would then take the first bus to the border and hope he could get across before they closed it. At the count of 8, he was turning away, his planning curdling into self-loathing, fear hammering urgency into every movement, when the steel door slid open. He was in. The reason for the delay would remain a mystery. Perhaps subtle changes to the eyes had confused the system and forced it to use a more complex algorithm. Or maybe it had to rouse itself from a standby mode, but he didn't care. He strode along the corridor, through the steel door and into a large atrium, all the time anticipating a sense of elation at his achievement. Instead, his hopes plunged. Because of high walls, razor wire, and surveillance cameras, he had never seen anything of the Institute except the front facade. Without thinking about it, he had predicted the size of the building on that information. As it turned out, that was a serious error, perhaps a fatal one. Now inside the atrium, he could see that the place was huge. Only Allah knew how long it would take him to find what he was looking for in a place so large, while out in the world, at some stage, probably very soon, Klaas would be missed. When his friends or family couldn't reach him in the office or on his cell phone, somebody undoubtedly would drive into the parking lot to look for him. How long that gave him, the Saracen couldn't tell. Maybe they were already on their way, but he knew now that time was short and the job was huge. As the Turkish proverb says, it was going to be like digging a well with a needle. Unarmed, totally at the non-existent mercy of anybody who came, he sprinted down the first of five broad corridors and jagged right when he reached an intersection. He stopped in mid-stride. Armored glass and an unmanned security desk blocked the way. Two guards, sharing a weekend tea with him just after he had arrived, had mentioned a special security measure somewhere deep in the building, which, based on their description of it, told him that it included a backscatter X-ray. Impossible to smuggle anything past because it rendered you as good as naked, the X-ray could also check a huge range of body measurements. The length of the right femur, the distance between the nose and an earlobe. Unlike with a retina scanner, you had to be who you claimed you were. No advanced medical facility in the world boasted armored glass and backscatter X-rays, and the Saracen knew that behind them undoubtedly lay all the most horrific things which were really being researched at the Institute. He never thought he would be able to access the inner bastion, and he didn't care. If he was right, he didn't need to. He turned and returned fast to the intersection. A foreign man in a foreign land, desperately trying to find something rare, but strangely, completely harmless. Just a box of small bottles used to protect the people who worked here. As he plunged into the next maze of corridors and offices, through pools of deep shadow, past looming shapes that could have concealed any manner of threat, lights along the baseboards and in the hallways suddenly burst to life. He stopped and wheeled on the spot. Somebody had entered the building and activated the lights. He listened with every cell of his being for a clue to their position. From far away, he heard a phone ring, a tap dripping, an exterior shutter banging in the wind. Its beat was almost identical to the rhythm of his pounding heart. He listened for footsteps, the squeak of clothing, the clink of an unholstered weapon. Nothing. Then he realized, and fear went back into its cave. The lights were on a timer, and night must have fallen outside. Chapter 18. All across the Institute's deserted parking lot, sodium streetlights hissed to life. Klaas couldn't see their yellow glow. He would never see anything again, but he heard them, and his heart soared. The arrival of night meant the clock was running out for the filthy Palestinian. A monstrous red pain had been spearing deeper into his forehead, and he could still feel blood weeping from his eye sockets. But the sedative was wearing off, and although the pain increased exponentially, so did Klaas's energy. He was a strong man, a fit man, but what was that worth if the spirit was broken? The thing which was parachuting him down, this secret knowledge sustaining him, was the fact that he had already been running late when he left the building. Now night had come, he knew the alarm would be raised in earnest. His wife and four adult children, waiting impatiently at his eldest daughter's house for a poolside gathering, would have already tried phoning all the numbers they could think of. One of his two barrel-chested sons, both making a name for themselves in their father's old outfit, would even have slipped inside and made a call to their father's mistress, ready to berate her for keeping him from his family obligations. Unable to locate him, and with darkness falling, the two boys, he was certain, were getting into one of their cars to trace his route, worried he had been involved in a wreck. As members of the secret police, both of them were always armed, and now all Klaas had to do was stay alive and help them find him as fast as possible. Despite his injuries, despite the pain and nausea, he knew how to do it. Working his face from side to side, loosening the bands of electrical tape binding his head, he gradually ripped his hair, flesh, and beard free of it. It was an agonizing task, but if he could get his head loose, he could use his teeth to rip at the tape around his chest and liberate his arms. Earlier, he had felt the fanatic pull the cell phone from his pocket and then see him grab the car handset out of its cradle. Moments later, he had heard both phones being smashed to pieces on the asphalt. But the idiot had left the engine running in case he needed a fast exit, and, knowing nothing about luxury cars, didn't realize it meant the hands-free phone system was working. If Klaas could get his arms loose and lunge forward to the driver's seat, he didn't need his eyes to find the button on the steering wheel which activated the car phone. And he certainly didn't need the handset. The last call he'd made had been to his eldest son's cell phone that morning, and hitting the steering wheel button would redial it automatically. All Klaas had to do was speak loud enough for the microphone above his head to pick it up.
"Office, gotta bark,"
he whispered, practicing. His son would recognize his voice, and Allah help the Palestinian when the two boys arrived. The woman's cries for mercy just before he first entered her, and then her pleas for a quick death many hours later, would sound like soft poetry compared with the song his sons and their colleagues would make the fucker sing. He was still repeating the two words, louder, stronger, when he finally tore his head and chin free of the tape. He gasped with the pain and would have cried for real if he'd had any tear ducts left. He sat for a moment to recover from the agony, and anybody cupping their hands against the glass and looking through the Cadillac's smoked windows at that moment would have seen a man with empty eye sockets, clumps of hair missing from his head, and strips of flesh ripped from his face. Had they continued to watch, they would have seen him lean forward to tear at the tape around his chest with his teeth, and, given his wild determination, they would have said it would be only a matter of minutes before he was free. Chapter 19. A tiny salvage diver worked tirelessly on the wreck of a Spanish galleon as five beautiful clownfish swam through the bubbles pouring from his helmet. The wall-sized aquarium's eerie glow lit the waiting room of the Institute's lavish executive wing, casting a shimmering shadow of the Saracen across the opposite wall. As he moved through the silent space, close to despair, not sure which corridor or alcove to explore next, he hesitated at the sight of the brilliantly colored fish. He hadn't seen them for 20 years or more, but he knew what they were.
Amphiprion ocellatus,
he said, surprised he could remember their biological name after so much time. Of all the tropical fish, they had been his father's favorites, and often, when he worked at the weekend, he had taken his young son into his seafront office and planted him among the huge research tanks. The largest was filled with sea anemones, the beautiful but treacherous flowers of the marine world.
"Look at the clownfish," his father would say. "They are the only fish in the world which the anemone's tentacles don't poison and kill. Why? That's what I'm trying to find out."
Now, so many years later, alone in a secret weapons establishment, the irony of it wasn't lost on the Saracen. Just like his father, he too was consumed by the search for something which gave protection against a deadly pathogen. He would have liked to linger with the fish a moment longer, try to remember more of what innocence was like, but there was no time. He started to turn away, and stared straight down a dark passage that he hadn't even noticed. At the far end was a door, and somehow he knew it was the room he was searching for, even before he saw the red crescent fixed to the wall. The sign, the Islamic version of the Red Cross, indicated it was the building's first aid and medical center. He had been told of its existence by a former employee, a nurse he had worked with at the hospital in Lebanon, but it was his father's clownfish which had guided him to it, and he took that as a sign from Allah. The door into the first aid clinic wasn't locked, and he moved inside fast, heading through the treatment areas until he found the supply rooms at the back. The purpose of the center was to handle any on-site illness and to conduct physicals for new employees. Hence, it had ECGs, treadmills, defibrillators, respirators, and enough other equipment to make any hospital proud. In the center of it all was a drug dispensary, and the Saracen entered it with the easy familiarity of someone with years of experience in hospitals. The wall behind a counter was taken up with boxes of pharmaceuticals and racks of surgical supplies. Another wall housed locked cabinets faced with steel grills, which the Saracen knew contained the Class A drugs, narcotics, hallucinogens, amphetamines, and various opiates used as anesthetics. He ignored everything. At the back was a smaller room, and in it he saw the row of refrigerated cabinets, which had brought him to this godforsaken country and forced him to live like a dog in a parking lot. In a surge of hope and anxiety, he moved along the glass-fronted refrigerators. His expert eye registered pouches of blood products, vials of temperature-sensitive drugs, and, as in hospitals everywhere, the food and drink of the staff. But nothing of what he needed. With each step, his desperation grew. Maybe every scrap of gossip he had heard, every assumption he had made, had added up to nothing more than a grand delusion. Like a fool, he had believed what he wanted to believe. Then he looked